Thank you for joining us today for our first webcast in Hunton & Williams' new series, Hunton Global Privacy Update. I'm Bridget Tracy, a partner in the firm's London office, and I lead our privacy and cybersecurity practice in the UK. These webcasts are held every 2 months and are formatted to provide informative updates on the latest issues in global privacy and data protection. We'll limit the webcasts to 30 minutes in length, and after the program, we'll post an on-demand recording on our privacy blog at huntonprivacyblog.com. As many of you know, our global privacy and cybersecurity practice has lawyers and privacy professionals located in the US, Europe, and Asia. We assist our clients all over the world with these issues. We're recognized as privacy leaders globally. For more information about our practice, visit our blog, as mentioned earlier, huntonprivacyblog.com. And for the latest on the European Data Protection Regulation, visit our tracker at huntonregulationtracker.com. Today we'll focus on three main developments. I'm going to discuss the latest updates with the EU General Data Protection Regulation, and I'll then turn the discussion to my colleagues to address recent safe harbor issues from both the EU and the US perspectives, and cybersecurity, again, from both an EU and US perspective. Let me turn now to the draft EU regulation. As many of you will be aware, the next 2 months will be key in determining whether the regulation will pass into law next year or be put on the shelf to await possible revival after the European elections in May 2014. Let's just remind ourselves of what the journey has been so far. In January 2012, the Commission published a draft General Data Protection Regulation. In summary, the regulation sought to harmonise data protection across Europe, to update the existing directive, to take account of globalisation and the increasing significance of personal data in a global economy, and to enhance individuals' rights. It reinforces many of the provisions of the existing directive, but it seeks to tighten up several existing concepts. To call out some of the key proposals, the regulation covers the processing of personal data by both data controllers and also processors. It expands the reach of European data protection law to cover processing by controllers established outside the EU who offer goods or services to EU data subjects or monitor their behaviour. It strengthens existing obligations relating to data processing. The controller is responsible for ensuring and demonstrating that each processing operation complies with the regulation. There's a more onerous data minimization principle and restrictions on the use of consent, which must be explicit and unambiguous. The controller has the burden of demonstrating that consent was obtained. There are some prescriptive requirements on a controller to adopt policies and implement appropriate measures to ensure compliance. Specifically, the regulation incorporates the concepts of data protection by design and by default and establishes the right to be forgotten and the right to data portability. On data transfer, the regulation does not really ease the restrictions on the transfer of personal data from the EU, but it does explicitly recognise binding corporate rules. Data breach is new. The regulation requires mandatory notification to both the supervisory authority and to affected individuals. The regulation proposes an array of mandatory fines for both negligent and deliberate breaches of the legislation, up to a maximum of 2% of an enterprise's worldwide turnover. From a UK perspective, many organisations will have a great deal of additional work to do to meet the requirements of the regulation. On the other hand, in Germany, there's concern that some of the provisions may not go far enough. Following publication of the draft, several committees of the European Parliament proposed amendments. Over the summer, the lead parliamentary committee, the LIBE committee, has worked its way through over 3,000 proposed amendments and is preparing a final version of the text for voting. Once the parliament has an agreed position, it will enter into negotiations with the Council of Ministers. The Council of Ministers is also reviewing the proposal and seeking to adopt an agreed position. Under the Irish presidency, publication of the first four chapters of the regulation indicated a markedly different approach by the Council. The Council's proposal moves away from a prescriptive approach to a risk-based framework. It even includes a new recital stating that the right to data protection is not an absolute right, but must be balanced with other fundamental rights, including the freedom to conduct a business. Now, this may or may not remain, but it certainly underscores the difference in approach. The Council under the Lithuanian Presidency is currently working on the text, and Justice Ministers are meeting in early October to review progress. So what are the next steps? Well, the Parliament and the Council are expected to adopt their positions before the year end, which would then pave the way for negotiations with the Commission, perhaps in December or January. There would need to be significant compromise to agree a text before the European elections in May. What happens if agreement is reached? Well, we'll have new legislation, likely a regulation, that will take effect without the need for national implementing laws. There's likely to be a transitional period of 2 years. What happens if agreement can't be reached? In this case, the proposal fails. A new commission might decide to start again, but the political landscape would likely be very different. If a new commission did pick up the regulation, it would probably start with the most recent draft in circulation before the elections. So even if the current process doesn't succeed, the draft text needs to be as good as it can be, given that it's likely to be a starting point for any revived attempt. What's likely to happen? Well, it's really anyone's guess. Commission Vice President Reding is pushing hard to get this through. Undoubtedly, Snowden and the NSA revelations have refocused European minds on data protection. There's plenty of speculation in Brussels that this will go through, but whether that is post-summer holiday optimism is anyone's guess. In the meantime, do watch and participate in the debate. And if you want to find out more about the regulation, visit our microsite, huntonregulationtracker.com. Now, moving on to our next topic, you may be aware that the safe harbour has been the subject of intense discussion in Europe in the wake of Edward Snowden's disclosures. Counsel Jörg Fladek from our Brussels office will explain the current European debate.
Thank you, Bridget. The US-EU safe harbour framework was approved in 2000. Since that time, safe harbour has allowed EU-based companies to transfer personal data from the EU to the United States by providing adequate protection to such data and therefore a legal basis as required by EU law. Recent events have now created uncertainty to the safe harbor framework and to certified US companies that rely on it. However, the European criticism of safe harbor is not new. Already in 2008 and 2009, the first review report on safe harbor took place, which highlighted a number of deficiencies with safe harbor from a European perspective. Back then, measures were not taken by the European Commission to change the existing framework. Doubtful of the safe harbor framework, in April 2010, only 1 year later, the German data protection authorities issued a resolution regarding safe harbor, which established a number of obligations for German data exporters before transferring any data to the United States. However, this resolution basically only meant additional due diligence tasks for German data exporters, but not any amendments to the actual safe harbor framework, for which the German authorities do not have any authority anyway. The authority to change the existing safe harbor framework lies exclusively with the European Commission. In early 2013, and following the publication of a proposal for a new EU data protection regulation, the report issued by the European Parliament's Libe Committee recommended that the EU should discontinue the safe harbor framework 2 years after enactment of the new data protection regulation. Additional signs of EU disagreement over the safe harbor framework could later be observed after the announcement of the transatlantic trade and investment partnership negotiations between the EU and the US. Because of the significance of data transfers in the context of international trade, the U.S. asked for cross-border data transfers to be included in the negotiations. However, not all stakeholders felt that trade negotiations were the appropriate forum for addressing cross-border data transfers. For example, Germany's Federal Data Protection Commissioner stated that the U.S. data protection framework is not sufficient and that the Safe Harbor program cannot compensate for these deficits. Recent events involving the National Security Agency's surveillance activities led to even more direct criticism and comments on safe harbor by the main EU stakeholders. Early in July 2013, the European Parliament has issued a formal resolution asking the European Commission to conduct a full review of safe harbor. The resolution states that some companies involved in NSA's PRISM surveillance program are certified under safe harbor. Further, the Parliament claims that PRISM surveillance may have involved a serious violation of EU data protection laws, and that the European Commission may therefore be obliged to reverse or suspend safe harbor. Later in July, the German data protection authorities again wrote a letter to German Chancellor Merkel to recommend that the EU suspend the safe harbor framework. In addition, Viviane Reding, the Vice President of the European Commission, who is in charge of the EU data protection reform, called PRISM a wake-up call and stated in the press release that safe harbor may not be so safe after all. At an informal meeting of the EU Justice and Home Affairs Council, she announced that the European Commission will therefore have a plan to conduct a full review of safe harbor by the end of this year. In context of the NSA developments, the German DPA also issued a press release stating that they would halt data transfer approvals and consider suspending data transfers based on the safe harbor. Clearly, these statements are meant to put pressure on the German government to influence the process on EU level and to achieve an indefinite suspension of the European Commission's adequate decision on safe harbor. It remains to be seen, however, what the practical implications of these statements are and whether the DPAs will actually adopt a different approach when being asked by companies to approve their data transfers. After almost 5 years of more or less direct criticism of safe harbor, it is probably fair to say from a European perspective that it is not a surprise that the European Commission finally considers a full review of the existing safe harbor regime in context of the revisions of the European Data Protection Framework. Safe harbor has become under serious scrutiny by the EU data protection authorities and the EU legislator. Certified companies in the United States should therefore carefully follow the ongoing legislative process in the EU as regards the proposed data protection regulation. It is also recommended to properly prepare for any meetings with EU data authorities when discussing cross-border transfers and to be mindful of the current criticism in Europe when suggesting safe harbor as a tool for EU-based companies to provide a legal basis for data transfers from the EU to the US. Back to you, Bridget.
Thanks very much, Jörg. And now US partner Aaron Simpson will provide a perspective on the safe harbor issues from the other side of the pond. Aaron.
Thank you very much, Bridget. I'm here to talk about the US perspective on the safe harbor. As you all know, there's been a significant amount of public discussion regarding the safe harbor's viability, particularly emanating from Germany as a result of the U.S. government's publicized intelligence activities. This discussion emanating from Germany has not fallen on deaf ears in the United States. In the United States, the safe harbor is definitely perceived as an important component of the broader trade activity between Europe and the United States. Since the U.S. government is generally pleased with the safe harbor framework, this update from the U.S. perspective on the safe harbor is primarily focused on how the U.S. government is responding to and reacting to the concerns that have been raised in Europe. In that context, the U.S. Department of Commerce has emphasized, and I agree with them, that it's important to ensure that everyone involved in the discussion on both sides of the Atlantic are working with the same set of facts when it comes to a discussion of the safe harbor. From a factual perspective, there's really two sets of issues. One would be a set of procedural issues, and the second would be a set of substantive issues. From a procedural perspective, there are many questions from businesses regarding the current status of the safe harbor, whether it's a viable data transfer mechanism. And in this regard, it's important to understand, and the staff at the Department of Commerce has sought to make this point clear, that the safe harbor framework is an agreement between the U.S. Department of Commerce and the European Commission. And this agreement has had an adequacy determination from the European Commission for data transfers for 13 years. Now, the words of this agreement do not allow any single EU member state to unilaterally terminate the safe harbor. And thus, at this time, at least from a procedural perspective, the safe harbor remains a viable data transfer mechanism for transfers between the member states of the European Union, the European Economic Area, and the United States. Now, that is not to say that the concerns in Europe are not valid or worthy of deep consideration. Of course they're valid, and they need to be considered, and they are being considered. But at this time, there's no mechanism within the safe harbor to allow a single European member state to unilaterally stop a company from transferring personal data to the United States, but for very, very limited exceptions. Now, from a substantive perspective, which is the second set of issues, many of the concerns that are emanating from Europe have resulted from these same publicized intelligence activities of the U.S. government. While these concerns are definitely valid and will form the foundation of a robust discussion going forward, the truth is that the Safe Harbor framework explicitly does not apply to disclosures of personal information for national security, public interest, or law enforcement purposes. This is something that was agreed to by the European Commission and the U.S. government and is reflected in the Safe Harbor framework documents. It's also important to bear in mind that other approved data transfer mechanisms approved by the European Commission, as well as non-EU countries that have been deemed adequate by the Commission, have similar built-in exceptions for these types of disclosures. So substantively, some of the concerns that have been raised with respect to Safe Harbor in particular are actually issues that are going to arise with respect to a variety of different data transfer mechanisms. Going forward, there's no question that the U.S. government is taking seriously the concerns coming from Europe on the topic of the Safe Harbor. And this issue will certainly be a topic of interest to many folks at the Data Protection Commissioners Conference next week in Warsaw. And representatives from both the Federal Trade Commission in the United States and the Department of Commerce will be in attendance. And there are other conferences planned throughout the fall and into the winter where U.S. representatives and EC representatives will come together. And so this will be something that we definitely will be keeping an eye on as we progress from the fall into the winter. With that, I'll turn it back over to Bridget.
Thanks very much, Aaron. And now moving on to our third and final topic. There have been numerous recent developments in cybersecurity issues. My partner Wim Nauwelert, who heads our Brussels privacy practice, will explain the European Commission's cybersecurity strategy. Wim.
Thank you, Bridget. As you may recall, last February, the European Commission issued a communication on a cybersecurity strategy for the European Union. The European Commission found that a harmonized EU cybersecurity strategy was needed to complete previous efforts at the national level, which was considered to be too fragmented to deal with the increase in frequency, the magnitude, and the complexity of cybersecurity incidents. The cybersecurity strategy presents the EU's vision on how to safeguard cyberspace and outlines the actions required going forward, focusing on five priorities, namely achieving cyber resilience, drastically reducing cyber crime, developing military cyber defense policies and capabilities within the framework of the EU Common Security and Defense Policy, developing industrial and technological resources for cybersecurity, and establishing a coherent international cyberspace policy for the EU that promotes core EU values. As part of this cybersecurity strategy, the European Commission proposed a draft directive on measures to ensure a common level of network and information security, or NIS, across the EU. The proposed NIS directive introduces a number of measures to enhance cybersecurity. For example, the requirement for EU member states to adopt a NIS strategy and to designate national NIS authorities to prevent, handle, and respond to NIS risk and incidents. The creation of a cooperation network to enable the national NIS authorities, the European Commission, and in certain cases, ENISA, as well as the Europol Cybercrime Center, to share early warnings on risks and incidents and cooperate on further steps. And last but not least, the obligation for operators of critical infrastructures in financial services, transport, energy, and health sectors, as well as providers of information society services and public administrations, to implement appropriate security measures and to report incidents that have a significant impact on the services that they provide. These incidents would have to be reported to the national NIS authorities, who may then decide to inform the public or require the companies or public administrations to do so. The European Commission actually gave some examples of companies that would be subject to this reporting obligation, such as app stores, e-commerce platforms, cloud computing service providers, search engines, and social networks. Hardware manufacturers, software developers, web browsers, news agencies, and publishers would not be subject to this reporting obligation. Examples of significant cyber incidents that would have to be reported include the unavailability of a cloud computing service, as a result of which users cannot access their data anymore, or the unavailability of an online booking engine that prevents users from booking flights, hotels, etc. Now, in order for companies to avoid dealing with all 28 EU member states when reporting cyber incidents, the European Commission has indicated that it will promote the development of common reporting systems. However, a lot of questions remain unanswered. So far, the European Commission has not commented on the possible interaction between the reporting duty in the proposed NIS directive and the new data breach notification requirements in the proposed General Data Protection Regulation. This question will probably remain unanswered for some time, as the proposed NIS directive has not yet been reviewed and or adopted by the European Parliament and the Council. Once adopted, EU member states will have 18 months to implement the directive into their national laws. In the meantime, approximately 14 EU member states have already adopted their own national cybersecurity strategies. The Austrian, Finnish, and Hungarian cybersecurity strategies, for example, were adopted earlier this year. In addition to the draft NIS directive, a directive on attacks against information systems was published in the Official Journal of the European Union last August, on August 14th, actually. This directive aims to approximate the criminal laws of the different member states in areas of attacks against information systems. It does not address the prevention of NIS risk and incidents or the response to NIS incidents, which is covered by the draft NIS directive that I discussed earlier. The new directive builds on rules that have been in force actually since 2005 and was adopted to address emerging threats that were not considered when the 2005 rules were adopted. For example, the emergence of large-scale attacks against information systems and increased criminal use of so-called botnets. These are networks of infected computers that can be remotely controlled to stage large-scale coordinated attacks. The Directive on Attacks Against Information Systems introduces a new range of criminal offenses, for example, the use of botnets. But it also increases the level of criminal penalties in these cases, for example, to a maximum term of imprisonment of at least 2 years or 5 years for offenses committed within the framework of a criminal organization. In addition, the new directive aims to improve European criminal justice and police cooperation by obliging EU member states, for example, to make sure that urgent requests are handled within 8 hours. EU member states have 2 years to implement this new directive into their national laws, and it remains to be seen how the directive will actually be implemented, and in particular how concepts such as serious damage or critical infrastructure information system will be interpreted. What is certain is that cyber incidents will remain a challenge in the EU, just as they are in the US, and the proposed NIS directive, as well as the new EU directive on attacks against information systems, may not be enough to ensure overall cybersecurity. Back to you, Bridget.
Just picking up on that last point, our global practice head, Lisa Soto, will now wrap up with an update on cyber issues in the US. She's also going to cover the White House administration's draft preliminary cybersecurity framework. Lisa, thank you.
Thank you very much, Bridget. In the U.S. during the last few months, there's been an enormous amount of activity on the cybersecurity front. First, the threat landscape continues to escalate. For example, in the last several weeks, we've seen unprecedented activity by the Syrian Electronic Army following the initial allegations of chemical weapons in Syria. The SEA targeted prominent media outlets like the New York Times, CNN, the Washington Post, and even Al Jazeera, by compromising the relevant domain registrars to alter the domain name server pathway for the targeted websites. The FBI has commented that this shows a whole new level of sophistication in attacking the domain name registrars compared with the SEA's prior, less sophisticated tactics of sending standalone phishing emails to target individual organizations. While we continue to see attacks on systems and networks in just about every industry sector, the real frenzy of activity in the cyber arena involves compliance with the President's executive order on cybersecurity. Consistent with the aggressive deadlines imposed by the executive order, there is a good deal of progress to report. First, in early August, the White House announced recommendations on incentives that could be used to encourage owners and operators of critical infrastructure to comply with the new cybersecurity framework that's being drafted. As you might recall, the executive order required the Department of Commerce, the Department of Homeland Security, and Treasury to figure out how to incentivize companies to voluntarily adopt the framework. The White House, of course, recognized that adopting best cyber practices is enormously expensive for private sector organizations, so the relevant agencies have worked to identify potential incentives to get companies to comply. The agencies have now provided their recommendations to the President, and the key incentives involve insurance incentives, adoption of the framework as a condition for federal grants, and probably most importantly, the possibility of limiting liability for companies that adopt the framework. I'll note that the Treasury Department considered and rejected the use of tax incentives to spur cyber investments. They concluded that a tax incentive would likely come at the expense of foregone revenue for the government. During the next few months, the relevant agencies will continue to examine the options that they did choose to pursue to determine which ones to adopt. Perhaps the most important development in the cybersecurity arena is the issuance by NIST in late August of a draft cybersecurity framework. With this release, the government appears to be one step closer to finalizing what will become a framework of best practices in securing the IT systems of critical infrastructure in the U.S. The draft framework has been developed in collaboration with industry through a series of workshops, the most recent of which was held last week in Dallas. The preliminary framework consists of three parts. First, there's the framework core, which lists cybersecurity activities companies typically undertake and also lists references to various information sources. The core consists of five functions: identify, protect, detect, respond, and recover. Of course, there's nothing new in this list, but it is useful to have it all in one place as a cohesive reference source. The second part is called the implementation tiers, and this part is intended to indicate how cybersecurity risk is managed within an organization. The tiers range from 0 to 3, with 3 indicating the most effective level of protection. The third part is the framework profile, which provides guidance on how to integrate the core functions within a cybersecurity risk strategy. The draft framework also contains a methodology to address privacy and civil liberty considerations. There are privacy methodologies listed for each of the major functions, including when identifying cyber risks, when detecting anomalies, and when responding to incidents. The privacy portion appears to still be in a formative phase, and in my view, requires additional refinement. While certain portions seem appropriate, such as the instruction to identify whether there are threats and vulnerabilities around personal information, other portions make very little sense, such as the mantra that's repeated over and over again to ensure that any personal information that's collected, used, disclosed, or retained is accurate and complete. It's hard to understand the relevance of this data accuracy instruction in each context in which the phrase is repeated. Also, portions of the methodology mirror EU requirements that we have not adopted in the U.S., such as the instruction to ensure that the collection of personal information be directly relevant and necessary to accomplish the specified purpose, and to retain personal information only as long as necessary to fulfill the purpose. As to the status of the framework, a complete draft of the framework is due in October, when it will be issued for public review. The final version will be unveiled in February of 2014. As a final note on the topic of cybersecurity, McAfee and CSIS reported this summer that cyber incidents are costing U.S. companies approximately $100 billion, billion with a B, annually. That alone is a sobering statistic, even putting aside the national security issues around cyber risk. Back to you, Bridget.
Thanks very much, Lisa. We've come to the end of our time and the end of our webcast. Thank you for joining us. I just want to remind you that we'll provide an on-demand recording of the program to all registrants, and it will be posted on our privacy blog. We look forward to having you again at our next program, scheduled for Thursday, the 21st of November. Thank you.